Do you feel a shiver up your spine from fear? Yes, it's another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind. Amp up your imagination and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. Rouse Him Not by Manly Wade Wellman. The side road in from the paved highway was heavily graveled but not tightly packed except for two ruts. John Thunstone's black sedan crept between trees that wove their branches together overhead. Gloom lay in the woods to right and left. Once or twice, he thought he heard a rustle of movement there. Maybe half a mile on, he came to the house. It was narrow and two-storied, vertical planks stained a soft brown. A tan pickup truck was parked at a front corner. Thunstone got out of the sedan. He was big and powerfully built, with gray streaks in his well-combed dark hair and trim mustache. He wore a blue summer suit. In one broad hand, he carried a stick of spotted wood with a bent handle and a silver band, but he did not lean on it. Walking the flagged path to the front steps, he studied the house. Two rooms and a kitchen below, he guessed, another room and probably a bath above. A slender girl in green slacks and a paint-daubed white blouse came to the open door. "Yes, sir?" she half challenged. He lifted a hand as though to tip the hat he did not wear. "Good afternoon. My name is John Thunstone, a researcher into old folk beliefs. I came because yonder at the county seat they told me an interesting story about this place." "Interesting story?" She came out on the stoop. Thunstone thought she was 18 or 19, small but healthy, with a cascade of chestnut hair. Her long face was pretty. In one hand she held a kitchen knife, in the other a half-peeled potato. "Interesting story?" she said again. "About a circle in your yard," said Thunstone, "with no grass on its circumference. It's mentioned briefly in an old folklore treatise, and I heard about it at your courthouse today." "Oh, that," she said. "Here comes Bill, my husband. Maybe he can tell you." A young man carrying a big pair of iron pincers came around the corner of the house. He was middle-sized and sinewy, in dungarees and checkered shirt and with a denim apron. He had heavy hair and close-clipped beard and a blotch of soot on his nose. No older than, say, 22, this couple, reflected, Thunstone had married early. "Yes, sir," said the young man. "This is Mr. Thunstone, Bill," said the girl. "Oh, I didn't say who we were. This is my husband, Bill Bracey, and my name's Prue." "How do you do?" said Thunstone, but Bill Bracey was staring. "I've seen your picture in the papers," he said. "Read about your researches into the supernatural?" "I do such things," nodded Thunstone. "At your county seat, I looked up the old colonial records of the trial of Cret Marrowby for sorcery." "Yes, sir," said Bill Bracey. "We've heard of that, too." "Mr. Packer, the clerk at the court, mentioned this house of yours," went on Thunstone. "He called it the Trumbull House, and said that there's a circular patch in the yard, and some old people connect it with the Marrowby case." He looked around him as though in quest of the circular patch. "That's around the backyard," said Prue Bracey. "We've only lived here a few months. When we bought from the Trumbulls, they say we'll do well to leave the thing alone." "Might I see it?" asked Thunstone. "I'll show it to you," said Bill Bracey. "Prue, could you maybe fix us some drinks?" "Come this way, sir." He and Thunstone rounded the corner of the house and went into the backyard. That was an open stretch of coarse grass with woods beyond. "There it is," said Bracey, pointing with his tongs. Almost at the center of the grassy stretch lay a moist roundness, greener than the grass. Thunstone walked towards it. The circle seemed 9 or 10 feet across. It was bordered with a hard base ring of pale brown earth. Thunstone paced all around, moving lightly for so large a man. The inner expanse looked somewhat like a great spot of wet spinach. It seemed to stir slightly as he studied it. It seethed. He reached out with the tip of his spotted stick. "Don't," warned Bracey, but Thunstone had driven the stick into the mass. For a moment something seemed to fasten upon the stick, to drag powerfully upon it. Thunstone strongly dragged it clear and lifted it. What had touched the dampness showed a momentary churning whirl. He heard, or imagined, a droning hum. I did that when we first came here, Bill Bracey said, a tremble in his voice. I put a hoe in there, and the hoe popped out of my hand and was swallowed up before I looked. It didn't get my cane. He looked at Bracey. Why did it take your hoe? I wondered myself. I haven't fooled with it again. Bracey's bearded face was grave. I should explain. Prue and I came here from New York because the house was so cheap. She paints. She's going to do a mural at the new post office in town. And I make metal things, copper and pewter, and sell them here and there. Mr. and Mrs. Trumbull wanted to get rid of the house, so we got it for almost nothing. They told us what I told you. Leave that sinkhole thing alone. Do that, Mr. Trumbull said, and it will leave you alone. But you lost a hoe in it? Thunstone remanded. Yes, sir, Bracey nodded heavily. And when it came to evening that day, we heard noises, sort of a growling noise, over and over. I wanted to go out and check, but Prue wouldn't let me. She was frightened, she prayed. And that's the last time we've meddled in it. And how about a drink now? In a moment. Thunstone studied the outer ring intently. It was of bald, hard earth, like baked pottery. Again, he measured the distance across with his eye. Rings of that dimension have been common in old witchcraft cases, he reflected. They're about the size to hold a coven of 13 sorcerers, standing together, perhaps dancing together. Circles were always mysterious things, whether they were old or new. He turned back to Bracey. I'll be glad for that drink you mentioned, he said. They returned to the house and entered a small, pleasant front room. There were chairs and a table and a sofa draped in a handsome Indian blanket. A small fireplace was set in a corner. Prue Bracey was making highballs at the table. They sat down and drank. I explained to Mr. Thunstone how we were advised to leave that thing alone, said Bracey. I'm not sure it should be left alone, said Thunstone, sipping. Let me tell you some things I found out earlier today when I was at the courthouse. He referred to a sheaf of notes to read some of his conversation with a clerk packer. He quoted what brief record the ancient county ledgers had of the execution long ago of Cret Merrowby. At that time in colonial history, George II's Act of 1735 obtained to repeal the death penalty for witchcraft, but for a mass of odd charges, Merrowby had been put in jail for a year, with a public appearance in the pillory every 3 months. His execution had been simply for the murder of a minister of the local church, the Reverend Mr. Herbert Walford. And it was ordered that he be buried outside the churchyard, Thunstone finished. Confession or not, they thought he was evil, suggested Bill Bracey. Is that all you have on the case? So far it is, replied Thunstone. Yet I hope for more. Mr. Packer spoke of an old resident named Ritson. That one, broke in Bill Bracey, not very politely. He's one of those crusty old character that got weaned on a pickle. We met him when we first came here. Tried to make friends, and he just turned the acid on us. I'll try to neutralize his acid, said Thunstone and rose. I'll go now, but I have a cheeky favor to ask. I want to come back here tonight and stay. Prue blinked at him very prettily. Why, she said, we don't have a spare room. But there's a sofa if you don't have a place to stay. I'm checked into the Sullivan Motel in town, but right here is where I want to be tonight, said Thunstone. The sofa will do splendidly for me. He went to the door. Thank you both. Will you let me fetch something for supper? I'll shop around in town. He went to the soft-lighted grill room of the Sullivan Motel, for there, Packer had told him, old Mr. Ritson habitually sat and scowled into a drink. Sure enough, there at the bar sat a gray man, old and hunched, harshly gaunt, where Thunstone was blocky. It must be Ritson. He was dressed in shabby black like an undertaker's assistant. His lead pale hair bushed around his ears. His nose and chin were sharp as daggers. Thunstone sat down on the stool next to him. From the bartender, he ordered a double bourbon and water. Then he turned to the old man. I think you're Mr. Ritson, he asked. The other turned bitter, beady eyes upon him, clamped a thin mouth between sharp nose and sharp chin. So you know who I am, came the grumpiest of voices. I know who you are, too. This Thurston fellow, who's come to poke into what ain't none of his business, huh? And you want to ask me something? Yes, said Thunstone evenly. I thought I'd ask you what you'd like to drink. Huh? The beady eyes quartered him and then gazed into an empty glass. I'll have what you're having. The bartender brought the drinks. Ritson gulped at his. Thunstone lifted his own glass, but did not sip. "I've been told that you know past history here, Mr. Ritson," he tried again, "about the case of a man named Marrowby, long ago hanged for murder and buried here." Skimpy gray brows drew down above the unfriendly eyes. "Why in hell should I tell you a word of what I know?" "If you don't," said Thunstone, "I'll have to go to Mr. Packer, the clerk."
"Packer?"
Ritson squealed. "What does he know? Hell, mister, he wasn't even born here. He doesn't know old-time town history. He just sort of mumbles about it."
"But if you won't talk to me, I must look for information wherever I can get it."
"What information could Packer give you? Look here, my folks was here ever since the town was built, way back before the Revolution. Sure, I know about the Marrowby thing. When I was a boy, my great-grandmother told me what she'd heard from her grandfather, who was young here at the time. Better than 240 years back, I calculate."
Ritson swigged down the rest of his drink. "Bring this gentleman another," Thunstone told the bartender, putting down some money. "Now, Mr. Ritson, what did you hear from your great-grandmother?"
"It happened a long lifetimes ago. They'd had Marrowby up for his magic doings. He could witch people's dinners off their tables to his house. He'd make a girl leave her true love to come to him. All the law gave him for that was just a year in the jailhouse."
"But he was hanged at last," said Thunstone.
"That he was, higher than Haman," nodded Ritson above his second drink. "The way it was told to me, he killed a preacher. Can't recollect the preacher's name. Who'd read him out of the church?"
"The preacher's name was Walford," supplied Thunstone.
"Whatever the name was, he died of a stab in the heart. And at Marrowby's house, they found a wax dummy of the preacher, with a needle stuck in it."
"Where was Marrowby's house?" asked Thunstone.
"Why, out yonder where the Trumbull house is, where them young folks took over. Maybe the charge wouldn't have stood, but Marrowby pleaded guilty in court, and they built a scaffold in the courtyard and strung him up," Ritson drank. "I heard the whole tale. He stood up there and confessed to black magic, confessed to murder. He said he had to repent or else he'd go to hell. He warned the folks who watched."
"What was his confession?" Thunstone asked.
"Seemed like he warned all who were there not to follow black magic. Said he must confess and repent. And he said a thing I don't know the meaning of."
"Here," said Thunstone. "I haven't touched this drink." He shoved the glass to Ritson's hands.
"What did he say?"
"It didn't make sense. He warned them not to be familiar."
"Familiar?" echoed Thunstone, interested. "Said, let familiar alone. The like of that strange word," said, "rouse him not," and swung off.
"And that's all?"
"Yes. They buried him outside the churchyard and drove an ash stake into his heart to make sure he wouldn't rise up. That's the whole tale. But don't you go writing it."
"I won't write it," Thunstone promised him. "Mind that you don't. Now, I've told you what I heard, and I hope it's enough."
"I hope the same," said Thunstone.
"Will you excuse me? Good afternoon."
"What's good about it?" snorted Ritson halfway through his third drink. Thunstone went to his motel and changed into rougher clothes. Chino slacks and a tan shirt and a light brown jacket. He thrust a flashlight into the jacket pocket. Around his neck hung a tarnished copper crucifix. He found a lunch stand and bought a plastic bucket of barbecued ribs, a container of slaw, and bottles of beer. Then he drove to the Bracey house. The Braceys welcomed him and enthused hungrily over the barbecue. "It just so happens that I'm baking cornbread," said Prue. "That will go well with it." As the sun sank toward the trees, they ate with good appetite. Prue asked about Thunstone's crucifix, and he told her he had inherited it from his mother. When they had finished eating, Prue carried the dishes to the kitchen and came back with blankets over her arm. "Will these be all right for tonight?"
"They'll be splendid. Many a night I've lain on harder beds than your sofa. But before I do that, there's business to be done outside as soon as it gets dark."
"I'll come along," volunteered Bill, but Thunstone shook his massive head.
"No. Two of us out there will be a complication," he said quietly. "This business will require careful handling and some luck and playing by ear."
"Whatever you say," granted Bill, and Prue looked relieved.
"I won't promise to win ahead of things," went on Thunstone, "but I'll be specially equipped. Look here." He grasped the shank of his cane in his left hand and turned a crook with his right. The cane parted at the silver ring, and he drew out a lean, pale, shining blade.
"That's a beautiful thing," breathed Prue. "It must be old."
"As I understand, it was forged by St. Dunstan, something like 1,000 years ago. See what these words say at the edge? Both Bracies leaned to study. Bill moved his bearded lips soundlessly.
It looks like Latin, he said. I can't make it out.
Sic perant imicitui, Domine, Thunstone read out the inscription. So perish all thine enemies, O Lord. He translated.
It's a silver blade, and St. Dunstan was a silversmith, and faced and defeated Satan himself.
Bill was impressed.
That must be the only thing of its kind in the world, he ventured.
No, there's another. Thunstone smiled under his mustache. It belongs to a friend of mine, Judge Keith Hillary Purvisant. Once I defeated a vampire with this blade, and twice I've faced werewolves with it, as well as other things.
I don't feel right letting you go out there while I stay here, said Bill, almost pleadingly.
Do me a favor and stay here with Prue. Thunstone bade him stay inside, even if you hear trouble out there. He got to his feet, the bared blade in his hand. It's dark now, he said. Time for strange things to stir.
Stir? Bill echoed him, his hand to his bearded chin. Will that old sorcerer stir the one they call Marrowby?
Not as I see it, said Thunstone. Not if they drove an ashen stake through him to keep him quiet in his grave.
No, something else, I judge. I expect to see you later when things are quieter.
He went to the front door and threw it and closed it behind him.
Night had crawled swiftly down around the house. Thunstone's left hand rummaged out his flashlight and turned it on, while his right hand carried the silver blade low at his side. The light showed him the grass of the yard, the corner of the house. He went around to the open space at the back. He heard something, a noise like a half-strangled growl. It led him toward the circle, while the bright beam of the flash quested before him. He came to where the ring of hard brownness bordered the soft green dampness. Again the noise stole upward, the strangled snarl of it. Thunstone stooped and directed the beam of light, then thrust the mess with the keen point of his blade. Powerfully, he stirred it around.
All right, he said, hoping his words would be understood. All right, come out and let's settle things.
The snarl rose to a reedy shrillness, and he felt a clutch on his silver weapon. He drew it out and thought the edge sliced something. Louder rose the voice, a true scream now, and something showed itself there in the swampiness. A lump like a head rose into view, with two larger lumps like shoulders just below it. Thunstone made a long, smooth stride backward, keeping his light trained on what was there. Two slab-like paws caught the bald rim of the circle, and the great shaggy shape humped itself up and out and stood erect before him. It was taller even than Thunstone, broader even than he was, and it looked nothing natural. In the dancing light of the torch, it seemed to be thatched over with dark, wet fronds and tussocks. Its head was draped with such stuff, through which gleamed two closely set eyes pale as white-hot iron. A mouth opened in the tangle, and out came a rumbling shout, like the roar of a great beast. It slouched heavily toward him, on 2 feet like shovels. Thunstone slid warily to one side, keeping the beam of light upon the creature, at the same time poising his blade.
"So here you've stayed," he said to it. "Marrowby repented, forswore you. He's dead. But you're alive. You're evil."
It roared again. Its great long forelimbs rose like derricks. Thunstone saw talons pale and deadly.
"Well, come on," said Thunstone, his voice quiet and steady. "Come on and see what you can do, and what I can do."
It approached in a squattering charge. Thunstone sidestepped in the last instant and sped a slashing cut at the bulk as it floundered past. This time it screamed so shrilly that his ears rang. It swung round toward him, and he turned the ray of flash back upon it.
"Hurt you, did I?" said Thunstone. "That's the beginning. Come again. Maybe I won't dodge this time."
It rushed at him with ungainly speed. He stood his ground. As it hurtled almost upon him, he lunged, a smooth fencer's lunge. His point went home where its chest should be. The blade went smoothly, sleekly in, with a whisper of sound. It penetrated to the very hilt, and liquid gushed upon Thunstone's hand. He smelled an odor as of ancient decay. A louder, more piercing scream than before. The weedy bulk almost forced him back. Then abruptly it fell away and down, and as it went, he cleared his point with a strong, dragging pull. He stood over his adversary, shining his light to see it thrash and flounder on the ground.
"Did that do your business?" he asked it.
"Perhaps not quite. Here, I'll do this." He probed to the point where the neck would be, and lifted the blade and drove it down with all his strength, as he would swing an axe. The head lump went bounding away on the coarse grass.
a full dozen feet. The body slumped flaccidly and lay still. "Sic perant imici tui domine," intoned Thunstone, like a priest saying a prayer for the dead. He stood tense and watched. No motion. He walked to where the head lay. It, too, was as silent as a weed-tufted rock. A moment, and then he turned back and went into the house, finding on his way with a flash beam. His feet felt tired and heavy as he mounted the steps. Pocketing his flashlight again, he opened the door. Bill and Prue Bracy stood inside, arms around each other. Eyes strained wide in terror. "It's all over," Thunstone comforted them, and went to the sofa and sat down heavily. He fished out a handkerchief and wiped his silver blade. The liquid on it was thick and slimy like blood, but it was green and not red. "When old Mr. Ritson said that Marrowby had warned about something familiar, I felt pretty sure," he said. "Familiar?" stammered Prue. "A sorcerer makes his pact with the powers of evil," said Thunstone, "and from the powers of evil he receives a familiar. Marrowby repented and died repenting, but his familiar stayed here, stayed hidden, without guidance, but wishing to do evil. I've put an end to that." "What was it?" wondered Bill Bracy. "It's hard to describe. When it's light tomorrow morning, maybe you and I will take spades and bury it. It's not pretty, I promise you that, but its evil is finished. I know words to say over its grave to ensure that." He smiled up at the blank-faced Prue. "My dear, could we have a fire there on the hearth? I want to burn this filthy handkerchief." Still smiling, he slid the clean blade into the cane again. Someone is Dead by R. Chetwynd Hayes. He was a tall, lean young man with a pale face and the smile of one who was hiding his natural shyness under a mask of easy self-confidence. The girl by his side was extremely pretty, ash-blonde hair, white skin, and wearing an expression of cynical amusement, as though her blue eyes had seen more than her years warranted. In contrast to her companion's neat black suit, she wore a colorful costume that bordered on the bizarre. The mauve blouse had a dangerous split down the center that revealed the valley between her breasts. There was a corresponding parting at the rear which offered the masculine eye a tantalizing glimpse of a white, smooth back. The black miniskirt was the stunted offspring of a broad belt and a splendid nylon-clad legs, riveted every man's attention and raised a storm of feminine envy. "I," announced the young man, "am Francis St. Clair, the world's only practicing psychic detective." He paused as though to allow time for applause, then nodded in the girl's direction. "This is my assistant, Frederica Masters. She answers to Fred." The silence suggested embarrassment. Six people looked, first questioningly at each other, then back at the ill-matched couple, standing just within the open doorway. At last, a plump young man with receding hair came forward and held out a soft, moist hand. "I'm Reggie Smith." Francis St. Clair briefly touched the offered hand and said, "Pleased to meet you," while the girl nodded. "We're delighted you could come," Reggie Smith poured out the statement. "Delighted and relieved. When we read your advertisement in the Ghost Hunters Weekly, I said to my wife." "That's me," an equally plump young woman stated. "I'm Betty." Francis murmured that he was charmed, and the girl nodded again. "I said to Betty," Reggie went on, "this is the man for us, didn't I, Betty?" "You sure did," his wife nodded violently. "Your very words." "Can we sit down?" Fred spoke for the first time, and there was a fusillade of, "Sorry, of course," until soon they were seated in a circle, eight voices searching for something to say. "I expect you'll want to hear all about the phenomenon," Reggie suggested at length. "No," Francis produced a gold cigarette case, fitted a cigarette into a grotesquely long holder, and lit it with a lighter that was shaped like a miniature coffin. "No, eyewitness accounts are never accurate. They embellish, over-dramatize. If there's a psychic phenomenon here, I prefer to see and hear it with an unbiased mind. Tell me about the setup." "Setup?" Reggie raised his eyebrows and looked questioningly round the circle with an amused smile. "We all live here." "I didn't imagine you were visiting," Francis watched a smoke ring drift up to the ceiling. "But are you all related, or what? This is a large house, and frankly, none of you are my idea of county." A large man near the fireplace grunted, and a petite little brunette next to him said, "Indeed," in a tone of voice which suggested a knife being drawn across ice. "We are three separate couples that share," Reggie Smith explained. "The housing problem is pretty acute near town, so we all got together and bought this place. It is divided into three reasonably large apartments, and altogether it works very well." "Do you swap?" Fred asked. "I beg your pardon?" The big man all but exploded in Francis' mouth. "You mustn't mind Fred. She's naturally depraved. Now, I think it might help if I knew all your names."
"Surely," Reggie motioned to the large man. "This is Roland Taylor, and next to him is his wife, Nina. Roland is chief clerk at Hackett's Designs."
"How's the designing business?" Francis inquired.
"Fair," Roland grunted, and Nina smiled sweetly. "And this," Reggie said, indicating a red-haired young man who sat beside a cool, serene young creature with the face of a Madonna, "is Jennifer and Leslie Halliday."
"Your occupation?" Francis asked.
"Chartered accountant," Leslie Halliday replied, "and I don't believe in the supernatural."
"Indeed," Francis flicked ash onto the carpet, and Betty Smith hastened to put an ashtray on the arm of the chair.
"Suppose you were to meet a headless man in the back gate. What would be your reaction?"
"I'd look for an explanation," Leslie said shortly.
"Very sensible. Now you're Reggie, how do you earn the necessary crust?"
"I'm a car salesman."
"I see," Francis sat back and stared thoughtfully at the fireplace.
"We have a chief clerk, a chartered accountant, and a car salesman all living in a haunted house.
One might say the mundane married to the outrageous. What time does the phenomenon occur?"
"Anywhere from 9 o'clock to midnight," Reggie replied in a low voice.
"Good," Francis consulted a gold wristwatch. "That gives us time to bathe, shave, and eat dinner. Tell me, do you eat separately or en masse?"
"Altogether, in the original dining room," Reggie stated. "It's more economical and labor-saving."
"Right. If you will kindly show us to our room, we'll prepare for the worst."
"I prepared 2 rooms, Betty Smith said coyly.
"Fine," Francis nodded. "We don't sleep together."
"Only on alternate Sundays," Fred added.
The dining room was oak-paneled and rather gloomy. The long table wore 2 white starched tablecloths. A collection of neatly placed plates and stainless steel cutlery reminded Francis of a well-dressed hardware shop, and 2 tall wax candles assisted the overhead chandelier in keeping the shadows at bay. Everyone had dressed, that is to say, the men wore mass-produced dinner jackets and the women long evening gowns. Francis was attired in faultless evening dress, while Fred appeared in a glittering silver creation that approached the frontiers of near nudity by having a strip of material at the front, leaving the back and ribs bare. The other 3 women greeted this apparition with unmistakable signs of disapproval, which was wasted on the recipient who seated herself at the table and examined the empty plates with greedy expectancy.
"What's all this, then? Fast day at the monastery?"
"Really, Fred," Francis sighed.
"One can't take you anywhere," he apologized to the assembly. "Sorry about this, but she is a genius, and is only trying to let you know. Shall we get on? I'd like to be well fortified before whatever happens.
There was a slight easing of the tension, and Betty Smith rang a small brass cowbell, which was a signal for the door to open and a large, raw-boned girl to enter, pushing a loaded food trolley.
"This is someone I haven't met," Francis said.
"Gertrude," Reggie announced, "she does for us."
"How do," Gertrude announced, placing a plate of soup in front of Fred.
"I does for them."
"Has Gertrude experienced the phenomenon?" Francis inquired, wagging an admonishing finger at Fred, who had already laid eager hand to spoon.
"She leaves before 9, Reggie stated.
"Nutting," Gertrude said, apparently anxious to stress her non-observation. "Nutting would make me stay in this horrible house after dark."
"Why?" Francis asked.
"It's bleeding haunted." Gertrude presented Reggie with a final plate of soup and departed.
"Not very bright," Betty informed Francis. "She's never seen anything but imagines a lot."
"But she's rather sweet," Nina Taylor smiled at Francis, and thereby earned herself a glare from Fred.
"What do you know about your house?" The world's only practicing psychic detective addressed the entire table.
"For example, how old is it?"
"Pretty old," Roland sipped his soup with an expression of distaste.
"Too much salt again. Elizabeth, I'd say."
"Bald," said Fred, scraping her plate with fast-moving spoon. The shocked silence was broken by Francis saying softly,
"Fred does the research. Never go on a job until we've looked into the background."
"Pseudo-Elizabethan," Fred went on, examining with a critical eye the plate of roast beef with Gertrude deposited before her. "Built in 1880.
"Oh?" Reggie Smith looked depressed.
Then he brightened. "I could have sworn the estate agent chap said it was genuine Elizabethan, but he must have meant the original house."
"Prison," said Fred, attacking the roast beef.
"Pardon?"
"This house was built on the site of a 17th century prison. It was knocked down in 1830. Your place was shoved up 50 years later.
"That's what made me decide to take the case," Francis explained. You get a lot of interesting phenomena on the site of old prisons. Do you remember the case of the Headless Strangler of Marsilia, Fred?
Do I not? Fred grimaced.
The bastard kept taking swipes at me with a dirty gray rope.
How awful for you, Jennifer Halliday gasped. What on earth did you do?
Bashed him in the unmentionables with me handbag. Turned out to be some joker dressed up.
We come across any number of fakes, Francis observed airily.
Surprising the people who get their kicks out of imagining they have a ghost on the premises. Still, I suppose it's better than taking to drink.
I can assure you, Reggie began.
I think our friends will be convinced in a few hours' time, Nina observed softly. It was possibly a good idea not to tell them the details. Surprise is a great educator.
I'm convinced already, Fred said, cleaning her plate with a piece of bread.
Francis, my love, something has just come into the room.
Indeed, Francis filled his glass with some inferior red wine.
Malignant?
No, I don't think so, Fred was peeling a peach. Rather sad, frightened. Nothing visual, but I can feel. It's near the fireplace.
All eyes were drawn in the general direction of the marble fireplace, and Francis murmured softly,
Keep your shirts on. Don't stare.
But it's too early, Betty Smith wailed.
Nothing happens before nightfall.
Nothing you can see, Francis commented dryly.
Power comes with darkness. Fred, where is it now?
Behind me, said the young lady cheerfully. I think it would like to tell me something, but it doesn't know how.
Masculine or feminine?
Fred closed her eyes.
Don't know. Very weak. Said, frightened, very frightened.
Hold on a sec. It's gone.
Sure, Francis watched the girl's face with some anxiety.
Put out mental feelers.
Fred remained motionless for a full minute, her eyes closed, and her face devoid of expression.
The silence was heavy with subdued fear, and Betty Smith whimpered.
Shut up, Francis snapped. This is not the time for an attack of the vapors.
Well, Fred?
Gone.
She opened her eyes, but the cynical, irresponsible expression was missing. Her body was rigid, the face paler than usual.
It's a strange one, Francis. Rather like the wailing waif of Battersea, but weaker.
His eyes were like chips of blue granite as his glance flickered from face to face.
You say nothing happens before 9 o'clock or thereabouts, but has anyone experienced a strange coldness, as though a door has been left open?
I have, Nina confessed, and once or twice it seemed that someone was staring at me. You know, feeling of eyes boring into the back of your neck.
Francis nodded. Right. Anyone else? And don't start imagining. I want facts.
Five heads were shaken and St. Clair smiled grimly.
One latent psychic, and the rest gross materialist, which means five of you shouldn't see or hear anything at all.
Let's have that girl in again.
You mean Gertrude? Reggie asked.
I don't mean the Queen of Sheba. Ring the bells so I can find out what she knows, sees, or imagines.
Betty shook the cowbell violently, and presently Gertrude entered wearing her outdoor coat and seemingly not happy at being summoned.
Do you want me?
Got to be off. Me mom don't like me out after dark.
Gertrude, Francis smiled genially.
You said a while back nothing would make you stay in this house after sunset.
If I recall correctly, you stated it was haunted. What makes you think that?
Gertrude hung her head and swung her left foot back and forth like a tongue-tied schoolgirl.
Everyone knows it's haunted.
You mean you have been told it is haunted? You've never seen anything unusual yourself?
Gertrude did not answer but continued to swing her foot. Her face was a sulky mask.
Well, Francis insisted gently,
have you seen anything?
Almost reluctantly, Gertrude shook her head.
So, Francis said, relaxing slightly, how can you be certain the house is haunted?
Want to go home. My mum said I must be home before dark.
When you've answered my question, how can you be sure the house is haunted?
Me gran, the words poured out in an unbroken torrent. She was passing here one night. The moon was bright, it was, and a bloody great man was walking the garden. A bloody great man in black, and his eyes glared, so my grand fair split her drawers, and he were walking on nutting.
You mean, Francis interrupted, he was walking on air?
Gertrude nodded violently.
Yes, walking on air. He was 3 or 4 feet up, but my grand could hear his foot treading on summit hard, and she ran like billy-o.
I bet she did, Francis smiled gently.
Right, that will be all, Gertrude. You can go now.
Gertrude escaped. She went through the door with great speed, as though anxious to demonstrate her grandmother's long-ago retreat, and presently they heard her footsteps running down the garden path.
So far, so good, Francis rubbed his hands with boyish glee. The pattern is familiar up to a point from
Then on? I don't know. By the way, where does the phenomenon take place?
Mostly in the hall, Reggie volunteered. But you can only see it from our sitting room. The sound effects can be heard all over the house.
I gather the experience is rather disturbing.
They all nodded, and Reggie added,
You can say that again.
Well, that being the case, forgive the question, why do you stay here?
Because we've nowhere else to go.
Reggie raised his voice.
Damn it, man. We've all sunk our last pennies in this place, and we like it. Frankly, you're our last hope.
Hope is a white horse galloping towards a limitless horizon, Francis murmured softly.
Very well. You lot scamper upstairs when the time comes, and Fred and I will sweat it out in the sitting room.
You sure? Growled Roland Taylor. There's a natural explanation, of course, but the whole damn business is pretty blood-curdling.
Quite sure, Francis rose.
You'd only be in the way. Your united fears would build up and feed whatever materializes.
I think we really ought to tell you what to expect, Betty Smith said. I know you've had lots of experiences with this sort of thing, but...
No, Francis shook his head.
Under no circumstances. It is important I have no preconceived opinions. I do not wish to be told the plot before I read the book. So upstairs with all of you, and leave Fred and me to make some necessary preparations. When it is all over, I will call you.
There were a few half-hearted attempts to discourage him, but finally they trooped upstairs while Francis and Fred retired to the Smith sitting room.
The girl grimaced. This is going to be a tough one, Frankie. I can feel the atmosphere building up.
Not to worry. He opened a small suitcase and took out a bottle of water, a roll of tape, and five little wooden crosses mounted on silver bases. I don't know if it will be of any use, but we might as well set up a pentacle, just in case a nasty gets rough. Let's clear a space. They cleared the floor furniture, rolled back the carpet, then proceeded to pin the white tape into the outline of a five-pointed star. On the apex of each point, Francis stood across. Then, having opened the bottle, poured some of its contents into five little silver bowls, which he placed on the tips of the inner points. He straightened up and rubbed his hands.
Well, that's done. Let's hope it works. Do you remember the demon of Colchester Road?
Do I not? Fred shuddered.
He chuckled the crosses at us and threw me around the room.
We've had a lot more experience since those days. Put a couple of chairs inside. You might as well be comfy.
They lifted two chairs over the taped lines. Then Francis drew the curtains and switched on the lights.
Storm coming up, he announced. Beginning to rain and the wind is rising. Listen to it. A gust of wind buffeted the house, and the rain could be heard lashing the garden.
Fred shivered. I hope it's not going to thunder. I don't mind spooks on the rampage, but I can't stand thunder.
Shouldn't think so, Francis comforted. Just a downpour. Do the gardens good.
Right, as the actress said to the bishop, all we have to do is wait for something to happen.
They sat on two spindle-legged chairs in the middle of the star, like two children playing with some bizarre game. Francis whistled and stared thoughtfully at the ceiling. Fred examined his fingernails, and once she yawned.
Francis spoke at last. I wonder what shape it will take. I can't help thinking the disturbances here has nothing to do with the present house. Probably goes back to the old prison. Listen to that wind. A few chimney pots will go if it keeps up. What do you think of that lot upstairs?
Fred shrugged her white shoulders.
Pretty commonplace crowd. That Nina creature's probably psychic, although she doesn't know it.
Suddenly, as a switch had been pulled, or a vast curtain had been dropped about the house, the sound of wind and rain ceased. An abrupt, absolute silence rushed in from all sides, and Francis gasped.
This is it, my sweet. Hang on to your seat.
For the space of 2 minutes, nothing happened. Then, from far off, they heard a door slam, followed by the sound of bolts being driven home. Then footsteps, loud, heavy treads that seemed to be crashing down on paved floor. They grew steadily louder and nearer before the sitting room door crashed open, and Francis saw that instead of the carpeted hall, a long, door-lined passage lay beyond. Coming towards them was a tall man dressed completely in black.
Quick, Fred, Francis snapped his fingers. What do you feel? What is it?
I don't know, Fred shook her head. I can't feel anything.
No coldness, no sense of presence, nothing.
What?
Francis stared at the approaching figure in astonishment.
But you must, girl. Look, there's a complete reconstruction out there. I'd say your actual 17th century prison, and that Charlie must be governor or something, and a nasty-looking brute. He's too.
The tall man approached as far as the open doorway. There he stopped and appeared to be staring at the wide-eyed couple seated in the pentacle. He was at least 6.5 feet tall and had a dark, intelligent, but evil face, framed with long, black hair. He was dressed completely in black. Black cutaway coat, black shirt and cravat, black buckskin trousers and black silver-buckled shoes. He carried a long riding crop, which he slashed spasmodically against his leg. "Here goes," Francis murmured, then raised his voice. "Who are you?" The black sinister figure continued to stare straight at him. There was a gloating expression in the dark eyes. "What is it you want?" Francis spoke slowly. "You don't belong here." The figure switched the riding crop several times, then, raising his left hand, began to prod with a rigid forefinger the empty space that lay between the doorposts. It was as though he was feeding an invisible wall. "What the hell?" Francis stood up, an expression of dawning comprehension lighting his eyes. "No, mate, it's not ready for you to come through yet. I'd push off, if I were you, and come back another day." The black figure dropped its hand and looked at Francis with deepening interest. The thin lips slowly parted, and a set of magnificent white teeth were bared in a mirthless grin. After a few moments, he turned slowly and began to walk back down the passage, trailing his riding crop along the right-hand wall, so that it made a rattling sound, slithered from brick to wooden door, then back to brick again. Without warning, the sitting room door slammed, and instantly the sound of pelting rain and howling wind flashed back into being. Francis jumped to his feet and raced for the door. He flung it open, tore out into the hall, and shouted, "Downstairs, all of you! Hurry!" Way up on the first landing, a solitary door opened, proving they had all been huddled in a single room for comfort. Then they came down the stairs, every face alive with fearful expectancy. In here, Francis led the way back into the sitting room, and the Smiths pretended not to see the rolled-back carpet or the displaced furniture. "Now," Francis said, closing the door and taking up a position in front of the fireplace, "we have just witnessed a scene which is without parallel in my experience. The present, the now, was blocked out, and we saw a stretch of corridor that rightfully belonged to the past. A tall, dark man walked up to the doorway and seemed to prod an invisible wall. Is this the phenomena you have all seen at various times?" They all nodded, and Roland Taylor muttered, "Time picture." "What?" "I said, a time picture," the big man raised his voice, "an image that builds up under certain conditions, rather like television waves, and we are the receiving sets." "I know all about time images," Francis snapped, "only they rarely come equipped with sound, and the viewer is usually a high-sensitive person, and she felt nothing. Why?" "I don't understand," Reggie Smith sounded and looked very distressed. "What's it matter if she felt hot or cold? The place is still haunted." "No," Francis shook his head. "Apart from the unknown presence Fred detected in the dining room, I've found no trace of psychic phenomena here." "But," Betty Smith was near tears, "the man, that awful passage, is a result of what I can only describe as a time slip. For a short while, part of this house reverts, for reasons I have yet to determine, to the original prison which stood on this site some 200 years ago. "Rubbish," Roland Tyler growled. "Don't listen to him. All we have seen is a picture of how the passage used to look. Ever thought of going through that door and meeting that bloke in the black gear halfway?" Francis inquired. Roland Taylor shook his head. "Frankly, no. I was too scared. But if I had done so, the entire picture would have disintegrated. Fancy trying your luck tomorrow night?" Taylor flushed and growled. "Certainly not. We're paying you to do the investigating." "Exactly," Francis smiled grimly. "I'm the expert. The policeman you are paying to catch the criminal, the soldier you have engaged to fight your war. Now, let's go one step further. Think carefully. How long would you say the passage was when you first saw it?" 4, 6 feet? Betty Smith ventured. "Oh no," Nina shook her head. 10 feet, I'd say. The man came out of a kind of mist."
8 to 10 feet, Halliday stated.
"Certainly not longer."
"This evening," Francis said softly, "I'd be willing to bet my bracelets on it being all of 30 feet long."
No one spoke for a full minute, then Roland Taylor asked quietly, "What are we supposed to deduce from that?"
Francis St. Clair stared thoughtfully at the speaker, then shook his head. "I'm honestly not certain. Perhaps when I said the house had slipped back into the past, I should have said was slipping, sliding down a time precipice. But why? Some people, special people, have entered the past for brief periods, but purely as spectators. We seem to be on the verge of becoming actors."
"That's absolute nonsense," Roland protested. "There's no way back into the past. Shadows, images of bygone years can manifest if the conditions are right. But the idea of living people being transported back is ludicrous."
Suppose St. Clair said quietly, you come to a river. It cannot be forded, and only one of you can swim. How can you cross?
Build a bridge, Jennifer Halliday suggested.
Bright girl, but how?
You have plenty of rope. There are trees on both sides, but the tallest cannot span the river.
A rope can be thrown across, but there is no way to anchor it. What is the solution?
A strong swimmer, Leslie Halliday began.
Ah, Francis nodded, then chuckled with boyish glee.
Go on.
Could swim across, taking the ends of two ropes with him. These tied to a convenient tree would make a rope bridge.
Exactly. Francis began to walk from one person to another, staring into each frightened or bewildered face, pouring out a torrent of words, clearly in the grip of some intense excitement. Two ropes and agile men could cross. The river, the limbo, would be bridged. But the important first step, the essential action, is to get a man over to the other side. Without him, the would-be travelers can only stand and... He paused, looked back into the empty hall, then swung around to face the seven bewildered people. Stare into the future.
What the hell? Roland exploded.
One of them came across, Francis was shouting. It's no use shaking your heads. No use mouthing platitudes. Impossible, far-fetched. It couldn't happen. It has happened. And one of you bloody well know it's happened.
The babble of voices rose.
Roland Taylor sneered and seemed on the point of striking the tall, elegant young man who appeared to be enjoying their discomfort.
You're stark, raving mad. I was against you being called in from the start, but I never dreamed you'd come up with such a harebrained, cracked-up stunt as this.
Shut up, Francis roared.
I said shut up and listen.
There's no other explanation. I know it must sound fantastic to people who have only traveled along the narrow road that runs between house and office, but reason it out for yourselves. Someone, some intelligence has bridged the great gulf that divides the past from the present. It cannot, I repeat, it cannot be a one-way operation. An anchor man was sent over, and he's here with us now.
They stared at him open-mouthed, half-convinced, on the verge of full belief.
You mean, Jennifer Halliday was the first to speak.
There's a ghost here?
Francis raised a slim eyebrow.
Yes, indeed, there is a ghost. Fred sensed it in the dining room. The ghost of someone recently murdered.
Murdered? Roland Taylor looked helplessly around the room. No one has been murdered here.
But you're wrong. Francis nodded several times. Someone has certainly been murdered. One of you has had the life force, the essential essence, the soul, if you will, driven from his or her body, and you are now possessed by an entity from the past. Or to put it another way, one of you is dead. The question is, which one? The one back to their rooms were, doubtlessly, they conjectured, denied, toyed with their fears, and Fred and Francis were left alone.
Can you contact the late departed? Francis asked.
A simple communication, a materialization, and our problems would be solved.
I doubt it. Fred shook her head.
You know what the newly departed are like. Frightened, not sure what has happened. They shy away from psychic contact like a teetotaler from whiskey.
But I can try.
Do that, Francis, guided her to a chair. Put out feelers and see if he or she is around. Then we'll take her from there.
Fred seated herself and closed her eyes. Francis stood behind her and gently stroked a smooth forehead.
Relax, he instructed in a low voice, but be careful. You never know what might be prowling around. Now search this room. Is there anything at all?
No, Fred said softly. Nothing at all.
Right. Now the hall. Put out feelers into the hall, but slowly. Take it easy. Is there anything in the hall?
Fred did not answer for some time. There was an expression denoting great mental effort on her pale face. Then she whispered,
I can feel something.
Wait a minute.
Yes.
Fear.
Bewilderment.
Almost total darkness.
Can you make contact? Francis asked. Try to bring it nearer.
Bring it in.
Hold your horses. This is bloody hard work. Every time I make contact, it shies away like a virgin from a...
She sat up and faced the closed doorway with tight-shut eyes.
All right now. Don't panic.
We want to help.
Get it?
Help.
Friends?
We're friends.
Don't get your knickers in a twist.
Come nearer.
That's the ticket. Nearer.
Keep your cool.
Keep it up, Francis rubbed his hands in anticipation. Keep going, you're doing fine.
Through the door, ducky.
Fred was leaning forward, her eyes still closed. Come on.
Wood don't mean a thing to you now.
Follow the blue light. All trains go to Waterloo.
What the hell?
What's wrong, Fred? The eager smile died, and he watched the girl with growing anxiety. Snap out of it.
What's the trouble?
Interference.
Fear? Terror? The bastard is onto us. Oh, my God. She began to jerk violently, writhing from side to side, and her voice rose to a scream. The pain! Get it off!
Break contact, Francis shouted. Let go. Clear your mind. It's only autosuggestion. Break contact, you silly cow!
Suddenly the girl went limp and flopped back in her chair. Two tears crept from under her closed eyelids and trickled down her pale cheeks. Francis rubbed her hands gently, then shook her. Okay, it's all over. Wake up, there's a good girl.
Fred opened her eyes, and for a while she stared up into the lean, anxious face.
Francis kissed her, then straightened up. All right now?
Yes. I made a bit of a fool of myself, didn't I? She shuddered.
I was caught off guard. The sudden flash of cold terror and the pain. It was as though I was being flogged.
Possible, Francis nodded.
Our tall friend would be accustomed to dealing out such treatment. Go on.
Well, that's all.
When I broke contact, I passed out. I fear we will never find the newly departed again. My own discomfort was only a reflection of what he or she must have gone through.
Well, one thing is certain, Francis said, taking out a cigarette case and putting a cigarette between the girl's lips. We have to make it the hard way. Watch every one of them and wait for the anchor man to slip up.
Nina has a psychic potential, Fred puffed at her cigarette. She could have been the magnet that attracted them in the first place. There again, Roland Taylor is always protesting, and he seems to have been up against you being called in. I think he's a prime suspect.
There's no more we can do tonight, Francis yawned.
So to bed. Tomorrow we must wrap the case up or call it a day, for I doubt if we can hold them here for longer than 24 hours. When the big fellow comes into this room, they'll forget their investment and be off.
Three men and three women sat in a rough half circle. Each face wore a suitably grave expression and returned Francis's searching glance with disarming innocence. The psychic detective took up his favorite position on the hearth rug, with Fred standing to his left. The girl was wearing the bizarre costume in which she had arrived, the white letters EV standing out over her bright breast.
"I've gathered you together," Francis began, "to report progress and in military jargon to put you fully in the picture. Today I did some research in the local library and was fortunate enough to find this." He took a fat volume from the mantelpiece. "Pilbeam's History of Clarence and Surrounding Districts. There's an entire chapter devoted to Clarence Grange. It seems there was a prison on this site. It was built in 1629 and demolished in 1830. Now, I don't have to tell you that a 17th century prison was not the best place in the world to land up in. And if the wrong man was charged, almost anything could happen. This brings me to the year 1742, for it was then, according to contemporary records, that a Mr. Royston Wentworth was appointed governor. There's little doubt he bought the post. Let me quote. He opened the book and began to read, but occasionally raised his eyes, as though to observe the expressions on the faces of his audience. Royston Wentworth was a man of goodly proportions and was well versed in the arts that pertain to a scholar and a gentleman. But he did not follow the path of the godly, but did pursue the hound of dark knowledge that righteous men shunned his presence. When in the year of our Lord 1742 he did take up the appointment of governor of His Majesty's prison at Clarence, he did make one Christopher Wyatt, his chief officer, and certain other men of ill repute were installed as turnkeys. By 1743, all the former staff had been turned away, and only Governor Wentworth's men were to be found in authority, and there was much talk of evil deeds performed behind those grim walls. At his trial, one prisoner, a forger and by the name of Jeremiah Watts, did testify that Governor Wentworth and the aforesaid Christopher Wyatt did cause a wall to disappear, and beyond did he see things that made his bowels move with fear. He did see a room where lights burned without flame and a glass-fronted box in which tiny images moved. Many of the inmates had become lunatics, and one was so bewitched he swore upon holy writ he was not of this time, but had been born in a century yet to come. Francis paused, then raised his voice. Which one of you was, or will be, he or she? Do not dismiss the idea of time transportation lightly. Many people have claimed to have been switched from one age to another, and when they have tried to explain the predicament to the authorities, have been treated as madmen. Remember, 10,000 to 15,000 people disappear every year in Great Britain alone, and are never seen again. Who is to say they are not wandering about the streets of medieval London, or rotting in some 17th century madhouse?
Jennifer Halliday raised her hand.
rather like a schoolgirl who wishes to ask teacher a question. "Please, if what you say is true and these people succeed in making their bridge, what will happen? Will they kidnap us?" "There is one present who can answer that question better than I," Francis answered dryly. "But I'd say the transfer will be one of souls, not bodies." Royston Wentworth was looking, or is looking, for an escape. He must have known his activities would sooner or later lead him to the gallows. By swapping personalities with someone on a far-off age, he would be safe. It would seem he intends to bring his staff with him. "It's unbelievable," Roland Taylor shook his head. "Too far-fetched." "Really?" St. Clair raised an eyebrow. "I would have thought you, of all people, would have found the situation most plausible." "What is that supposed to mean?" "It's supposed to mean this," Francis suddenly pointed a forefinger at the large red-faced man. "I believe you are the anchor man, the one they sent over to take possession of the real Roland Taylor's body. The bridge isn't complete yet, so the ghost of the poor wretch is still trying to make itself felt. Only you scared it off. That's why you did not want me called in. That's why you have poured cold water on the very idea from the start. That's why—" "You're bloody mad," Taylor got up, his face congested with rage. "You poor fool. Your theory is full of holes. I can sink it with a few words. Firstly, if I, or for that matter anyone here, is a refuge from the 18th century, how is it we all talk 20th century English? Huh? If you wish, I'll take that television set to pieces and put it together again. Want to know who my mother and father were? When they were born and when they died? Shall I give you a rundown on the history of the last 30 years? Care to watch me drive a car? Go and lock yourself up in the nearest loony bin." "How about that?" Reggie Smith smiled. "I can drive a car. Name the Prime Minister of England from 1920 upwards. That puts me in the clear." "I can type," Betty Smith said demurely. 60 words a minute." "I can ride a bicycle," Nina Taylor announced. "Type, do shorthand, use a telephone and an adding machine, and I saw Gone with the Wind 3 times. "I," Jennifer Halliday said, ticking off the list of her accomplishments on the fingers of her left hand, "can type, do shorthand, so long as it's not too fast, tell you the entire plot of Love Story." "All right," Francis raised his hand. "So, you are all clever boys and girls. Doesn't mean a thing. Messrs. Wentworth and company were brilliant men, far ahead of their time. They might not be able to type or take a television to pieces, but they knew the human mind. They had to do this little caper to work. When our unknown anchorman took over a contemporary body, he also inherited a 20th century brain, a full active computer with a first-class memory bank. No doubt he was scared stiff when his new body entered a car, but so long as he did not interfere, the memory bank would instruct the brain on what must be done. Sorry, Mr. Taylor, but you can recite the Encyclopedia Britannica backwards, and I'll still not be convinced you're not an 18th century black magician on the rampage." "Come to think of it," Jennifer Halliday said shyly, "Mr. Taylor was never particularly frightened when the phenomena took place. I often wondered why. Now I know I was. Because I didn't run around like a headless chicken. It doesn't mean I wasn't scared." Taylor glared at the girl, then back to Francis. "You've got a lot to answer for, St. Clair. Before you came here, we were scared of ghosts. Now we're terrified of each other." "True," Francis nodded. "And with just cause. One of you is an alien, a forerunner of a diabolical invasion. And don't think Mr. Taylor is my only suspect. For example, Mrs. Taylor could well be our, forgive me, our man. She has a certain latent psychic power which could well have drawn the alien to her." Nina Taylor started as though she had been struck. "I find that remark to be insulting, Mr. St. Clair. If you think I would allow the spirit of some strange man to take possession of my body, you must be madder even than my husband believes. Really." Just then Gertrude put in an appearance and announced, "Dinner is served," and they all trooped into the dining room, where they sat round the table in complete silence. Once, when Reggie Smith coughed, everyone jumped and stared at the offender as though he had suddenly sprouted horns. The rattle of cutlery on plates, the murmured request as someone passed the salt, the flopping of Gertrude's slippered feet as she moved round the room, all contributed to an atmosphere so sinister it could almost be tasted. Francis noted that Roland Taylor put down his knife and fork after a few mouthfuls and stared glumly at the opposite wall. "Francis," Fred said suddenly, "you might be interested to know our wandering recently departed is back." "Really?" Francis registered faint surprise. "Surely you don't mean that the ghost of the newly dead is in this room?" Gertrude screamed,
dropped a tray of sherry trifle and ran from the room.
"I didn't mean that your grandmother had dropped in for high tea," Fred retorted. "The poor coot is hovering behind our Roland's chair."
"Damnation!" Roland Taylor pushed back his chair and crashed a clenched fist down upon the table.
"What games are you playing, St. Clair? You've scared that wretched girl out of the few wits she has, and frightened the rest of us into the bargain."
"I'd better go and see if she's all right," Betty Smith rose. "I don't want to lose her. Help is hard to find."
"You scared, Taylor?" Francis inquired. "In a tizzy, are you?"
"Of course I'm scared," Taylor roared. "I've never pretended to be anything else."
"Then why don't you go away? I mean, forever, just until this matter is cleared up."
"Why should I?"
"Why shouldn't you?"
Francis turned his attention to the others.
"Why not all of you?
Get into your cars and drive to a hotel for the night. Tomorrow I might have some good news for you."
"Well, how about it?"
Before anyone could answer, Betty Smith returned and resumed her seat at the foot of the table. "I think Gertrude will come in tomorrow, but she's in a hell of a blue funk at the moment. We really must be careful what we say when she's present."
"St. Clair wants us to move out," Taylor said. "Pack our bags and spend the night at a hotel."
"Is that necessary?" Betty asked. "I mean, up to now, we've been perfectly safe upstairs."
"Up to now, I agree," Francis nodded. "But if Charlie Boy succeeds in completing the bridge, I'll not be responsible for your safety."
Nina shivered. "I say let's go. I keep imagining that great brute lumbering up the stairs.
I don't see why we have to leave our house because some blighter from the past sees fit to strut along a non-existent passage," Roland Taylor grumbled.
"Besides, think of the expense. Your bank account won't be much use when you've changed places with Royston, Wentworth, and friends," Francis retorted grimly.
"But the main point is, with you out of the way, Fred and I will only have ourselves to worry about."
"I suppose we could ring up the Green Boy," Betty suggested.
"I mean, they could be full up."
"They aren't," Francis grinned. "I took the liberty of making 3 reservations."
"Bloody cheek," Roland growled.
"Of course," Francis shrugged. "I expected one of you to object. I would imagine that Master Wentworth will be livid when he finds his anchor man is not at his post." Half an hour later, 3 cars went roaring down the drive, and a heavy silence descended on the house.
"Are you sure it's going to work?" Fred asked for the 3rd time.
"Nothing is certain in this world," Francis drew the curtains, then opened the sitting room door. "But I'd say one of them will find his or her way back. A lot depends on the anchor man being present between 9 and midnight. He might be able to operate from a distance, but I doubt it. It's the atmosphere in this place which is their greatest asset. No, the intruder, the possessed, must come back or the bridge will begin to crumble."
"What time is it?"
8:55, Fred consulted her wristwatch. "Any minute now. Might as well make ourselves comfy. No need to take precautions. They wouldn't help us anyway." Fred sank down into an armchair while Francis helped himself to a stiff drink from the sideboard.
"What about me?"
"No," he shook his head. "A sniff from the cork and you're away. I want your precious 6th sense fully alert."
"You're a pig."
"Yes, I know. People have remarked on my swinish aspect before. By the way, have you considered what our palsy walsy from the other side will do when he finds his anchor man is missing?"
Fred shrugged. "I don't know."
"Belt for the nearest church and demand sanctuary?"
"Not on your Nelly.
A high master of the black art wouldn't find much sanctuary in a church. No, he'll send another man over. He'll make a beeline for the nearest psychic medium to hand."
"You don't say," Fred considered the possibility for a few moments, then an expression of alarm widened her eyes.
"Wait a minute. That's me."
Francis nodded.
"You have keen perception.
But if he succeeds,
then it's the same as if I was killed."
"I have always observed," Francis commented dryly, "that you have a remarkable gift of summing up a situation in a few words."
"Oh, thank you very much. I'm to be a Judas goat?"
"Really, I wouldn't call you a goat. Let us say irresistible bait."
"You unfeeling bastard. I thought you loved me."
"I do," Francis nodded violently.
"If the worst should happen, it will be a great sacrifice."
"Suppose I'm killed," Fred demanded. "What will you do?"
He sighed deeply. "I'll have to learn to love someone else." Somewhere a little way off, a door slammed.
"Is that our wandering boy returned?" inquired Francis thoughtfully. "Or can it be Master Wentworth taking his evening stroll?"
They waited, ears strained to catch the merest sound, eyes alert for the unexpected. Then there came the sound of approaching footsteps pacing a hard surface, a slow vibrating tread that made a table lamp quiver, a resounding picking up and putting down of heavy feet, but the hall remained perfectly normal.
The thick carpet, the umbrella stand, the shaded lights all belonged indisputably to the 20th century. The footsteps came up to the open doorway, then stopped. They heard the sound of heavy breathing.
"Sound but no picture," Francis said softly.
"Come on, Charlie, whoever you are. Master is going to be very cross." Suddenly there was a loud crash, as though someone had kicked a wooden partition. After the lapse of a few moments, the sound was repeated, and Francis grinned.
"Temper, temper."
"Frankie, love," Fred spoke in a small voice, "I'm just the teeniest bit frightened."
"Well, don't be," he growled. "You're a professional, and you know what fear is a key that will open any door. You also know what might come through an open door. I remember..."
He was cut short by a tremendous shout, a mighty roar of rage that seemed to echo down a long corridor. And then came the sound of more footsteps, only now they were lighter, running.
"Stand by," Francis got up. "Reinforcements."
"Can they see us?" Fred asked in a voice that was not quite steady.
"I don't know," he shrugged. "Maybe. They certainly know we're here. I don't know if I fancy being watched by some weird characters from the 18th century.
Fred shuddered, then clutched her head with both hands.
"Someone is trying to get in."
"What?" Francis spun round, his eyes cold, his face an impassive mask.
"Explain, quick, girl."
"Cold fingers probing my brain. Pain, trying to get in." He reached her in two giant strides and gripped her arm.
"Blank your mind. Use your will."
"I can't. They're strong. Look into my eyes." He released her arms and clamped her face between his two hands, then tilted her head until their eyes were only a few inches apart.
"Fight. Think pain for them. He's burning up. His stomach's on fire. There's a bloody great fire in his belly. Red-hot knives are slicing through his head. He's drowning in a sea of white-hot cinders. He's going. He can't hold on."
From behind them, from beyond the open doorway, came the scream of a man in mortal agony, followed by the sound of retreating footsteps. There was another bellow of rage, then silence. Francis slumped down into a chair and wiped his forehead.
"That was a near thing," Fred gasped.
"Well, they won't try that again." Francis got up and poured himself another drink.
"Ye gods, I needed that. For a while I thought I'd have to go out girl hunting."
"What now?" Fred inquired.
"They'll wait for their anchor man to show. Which reminds me, where the hell is he?"
"It's not going to work," Fred shook her head. "Whoever it is, he or she could never get away from the others without raising suspicion."
"But he's got to," Francis banged his clenched fist down upon the armchair.
"Don't you understand? The bridge is being built slowly, night after night. If there's a break, all their work will be wasted."
"Then why won't we pack it in and leave him to it?"
"Because they would start again. If not on this lot, then on someone else. We've been hired for a job of work, and I'll be damned if..."
"What's that?"
Again, there came the sound of approaching footsteps, only now they came from outside. The crunch of feet on gravel, slow, fugitive treads that were barely perceptible, but conjured up a picture of someone approaching the house with extreme caution.
"Can it be?" Francis took a deep breath, and his eyes glittered with intense excitement.
"Yes, I do believe this could be our wandering boy. Fred, my love, may your seed be as the sand on the seashore. In a few minutes from now, the undead will come ambling in through that there door. Any bets?"
"Taylor," Fred nodded.
"I'll put me best pair of drawers on Roland Taylor.
Very fetching he'll look in them, too."
"Maybe. But I'd rather fancy that little Nina number. Quiet. Not much to say for herself. Well, here goes."
The faint, hesitant footsteps were coming up the front steps. A key was inserted in the Yale lock, then after a while, the door creaked open. There was a close with elaborate care. A shadow fell across the hot carpet. It elongated, then crept slowly up the right-handed wall as its owner advanced towards the sitting room. A figure gradually emerged to the open doorway.
"Oh, there you are," said Reggie Smith.
Francis St. Clair bowed.
"Good evening, Mr. Christopher Wyatt."
"I tell you, I came back because I was worried," Reggie Smith repeated.
"I was worried out of my mind."
"I bet you were," Francis grinned maliciously.
"The master was very angry. Can't say I blame him."
"But damn it all, I called you in. If I was the guilty one, would I send for the one person who could muck up the entire exercise?"
"Yes," Francis closed his eyes, then opened them again.
"Only I wasn't supposed to do anything. I was just a poor bloody crank who plays at ghost hunting.
No, Fred was the ace in the hole. A strong psychic who could produce that little extra something. A mere girl with a highly developed psychic gift
A pushover for a takeover. One more lad across the river. Perhaps the great man himself?
Really, of all the bloody rot, Reggie Smith protested.
Only, I wasn't the silly crank I was supposed to be, Francis went on remorselessly. I gave her the will to fight back, and your man retreated with a bloody nose.
Look, Reggie appeared to be on the verge of tears. I felt awful about leaving you two alone to face whatever is going to happen, so I sneaked back.
Why did you creep up the drive? Where's your car?
I came by taxi. The hotel garage was locked up for the night. I walked softly because I was scared.
You know something, F.S.? Fred inquired. I think he's telling the truth.
Maybe, Francis sighed. It's crazy enough to be true, or an elaborate cover story. I'm reserving judgment, Mr. Smith. But should circumstances prove my worst suspicions, look out.
Don't forget that.
Reggie Smith made a gurgling sound and looked fearfully at the open doorway.
Perhaps I'd get back, he suggested.
Perhaps you'd better not, Francis countered. Since you're here, I'd be obliged if you would answer a few questions. Has anyone in your crowd been behaving at all strangely?
No, Reggie shook his head.
I can honestly say I've noticed nothing out of the ordinary. Everyone has been on edge lately, of course, but that's only to be expected.
It would be strange if they were not. Tell me, what do you do usually between 9 and midnight?
Huh?
When a friend Royston takes his evening stroll.
What's the usual practice?
Do you always go upstairs?
Not at first, Reggie said thoughtfully. No, we all went out into the garden. But after a while, someone found the disturbance never troubled the upper stories. So we got into the habit of trooping upstairs.
What was the matter with the garden? Francis asked, his eyes closed.
Reggie shrugged.
Nothing, only it was damned cold.
Francis' eyes opened, and he stared intently at the empty hall.
Cold, you say?
Yes, Reggie frowned.
Well, the wind springs up over the downs at sunset.
So it does. Tell me, did you lock all the doors before you all trotted out this evening?
Of course we did.
Sure?
Of course I'm sure. Reggie frowned again, and his voice carried the faintest suggestion of a peevish tone.
We decided you had enough to contend with, without having burglars breaking in. We've been robbed twice, you know. Betty said...
You even locked the back door? Francis insisted.
And you doubtless ensured that all the windows were securely fastened?
Reggie was staring at him in astonishment.
Yes, it was my turn to be security man. One has to have an organization and a setup like this.
Fred, Francis drawled, a smile lighting his face.
I'm a stupid, block-headed fool.
Confession is good for the soul, that young lady quoted. I wondered how long it would be before the penny dropped.
A bloody, benighted, blind, deaf, half-witted cretin, Francis added.
There was the answer being served to me on a plate, and I hadn't the gumption to see it.
You can't help it, Fred comforted. It's the way your mother put your hat on.
You, of course, spotted the missing link, Francis suggested.
There was a short pause.
No, said Fred.
But you've cottoned on now? He asked, glaring at her over one shoulder.
She shook her head.
I haven't your brains. I'm only the hired help.
But damnation, girl, it's as plain as a nose on your face.
Speak for your own nose. I haven't a clue of what you are talking about.
I'm talking about the anchor man.
You must realize who it is. We've been so concerned with the impossible, we've overlooked the obvious.
Think, girl.
I am thinking, and it hurts.
Jumping beanstalks, Reggie, be a good fellow and do something for me.
Sure, Reggie brightened like a Boy Scout about to do a good deed. Anything.
Good. Open up the old lug holes and listen. Go and unlock the back door. Then walk around the house whistling.
Rule Britannia, when you reach the front door, come in. Shut the door and turn out all the hall lights. Got that?
Reggie concentrated.
Unlock the back door. Walk around the house whistling. Rule Britannia, come in front. Shut door, turn out lights.
Got it, he frowned. Why?
Never ask why, Francis shook his head gravely.
That word has ruined more kingdoms than you wot of.
Just trot away and do your little act.
All right, if you say so, but for the life of me.
When you come back, I'll give you a big kiss, Fred promised.
Oh, Reggie flushed a bright red and almost ran to carry out his appointed task.
Francis glared at his assistant.
You want him to break a blood vessel? Behave yourself. The balloon will go up in about 5 minutes.
From far off came the sound of a door opening. Then, after a considerable period, a short rendering of Rule Britannia that was accompanied by the crunch of approaching footsteps.
Never make the top 10, Francis observed.
But he's lovely, Fred stated.
The front door opened with an abruptness that suggested Reggie was grateful to leave the night behind,
Then the hall lights went out, and he stood in the doorway, beaming like a schoolboy who had successfully broken bounds.
"Did it!" he exclaimed.
"You're dead clever," Francis pronounced gravely. "Now, switch off all the lights and go and sit beside Fred. You can have a little slap and tickle before the fireworks begin." Reggie tore around the room, switching out lights, and in no time at all, they were sitting in total darkness, like three ghosts waiting for midnight. Once Fred exclaimed, "Hey, watch it!" and Francis swore. "Cut it out. Someone is supposed to think the entire bottom floor is empty. If you can't control him, suffer in silence."
"Really?" Reggie's voice protested plaintively. "I never..."
"Shut up," Francis growled. 15 minutes passed, then the hall clock struck 11, and scarcely had the last vibrating chime died away when they heard the first sound. A tiny bang, possibly a slight miscalculation when someone carefully closed the back door. Then, for a while, nothing, save a growing tension as they became aware of an approaching presence. Reggie whimpered.
"One more sound out of you," Francis whispered, "and I'll knock you for six."
A chair stirred in the next room and bumped against the dining room. A voice muttered a curse, then they heard the soft pad of feet muffled by the thick carpet. A dark figure, a shape of deeper darkness, slid obliquely across the room and became silhouetted against the rectangular blur of the open doorway. The voice was harsh, a shadow whisper.
"Master, master, they locked me out."
Light crashed through the darkness, and the sudden transition caused eyes to blink. So for a few more seconds, the identity of the figure in the doorway remained a mystery. Then Francis St. Clair spoke.
"So we meet at last, Master Christopher Wyatt."
Gertrude sprang around, her face contorted with fear and rage. The two men bound the long, raw-boned figure to a straight-backed chair, while she made raucous cries like a she-bear caught in a trap. Once or twice, the cries merged into words, words spoken in an accent which was a mixture of raw Cockney and West Country. The vowels slurred as to make the speech well-nigh unintelligible.
"Master, don't leave me alone in this awful place. I'm shut off."
"Right," said Fred, once the binding operation was completed. "I know you're just itching to show off. When did you realize it was Gertrude?"
"When Reggie said it was only cold in the garden.
You may remember Gertrude told us her gran had seen a man walking about the grounds, thereby implying the phenomena manifested itself in the garden.
It doesn't.
A close place, steeped in atmosphere, is essential for the bridge building. I should have suspected before, of course. Gertrude was a natural for a takeover. Simple, limited vocabulary that made the intruder's task easy. She was, if I can use the expression, made for the job."
"But she was always out of the house. Well, before 9 o'clock, Reggie protested.
"Unless, of course, she came back," Francis finished the sentence. "I've no doubt the back door was left unlocked until you retired to bed. But tonight you locked up before departing, hence we were treated to a show without vision. The camera was missing. The question is, what now?"
"You mean," Reggie stared with evident apprehension at the open doorway.
"All this supplication should get results sooner or later," Francis observed, watching the erstwhile Gertrude with some satisfaction. "Our future depends on how well we handle the situation when it occurs." Gertrude Wyatt twisted her head to one side and glared at Francis with dilated eyes.
"Master Wentworth, he know. He make you twist."
"He's a bit slow off the mark," Francis remarked cheerfully. "I should give him another shot if I were you."
"Master," the mouth was open, revealing an assortment of bad teeth. "Master."
"That's the stuff," Francis nodded his approval. "Bellow away."
"Look here," Franz protested. "I'm not all that keen to see old Nasty Chops. Can't we get Gertrude or whoever she is certified and leave the house to itself for a bit? You said the bridge would disintegrate once the anchor man was removed."
"And what about the real Gertrude? If we can't get her back into a rightful habitation, at least her death should be avenged. Besides, we've been hired to do a job of work, and I don't like leaving it half completed. So here we sit until Charlie Boy puts in another appearance."
He tapped the writhing figure on the shoulder.
"Come on now, a couple of more good bellows. Let's whip with some of the old psychic influence."
"Anyone fancy a cup of tea?" Reggie asked.
"I can soon put the kettle on."
"Not a bad idea," Francis agreed. "Make sure you warm the pot and none of those bloody tea bags."
"No sugar," Fred called out after Reggie's retreating figure, "and not too strong."
"Master Wentworth."
"I'm here," Gertrude Wyatt's voice sounded a little hoarse. "Gongi deliverenti voti."
"That sounds a bit technical," Francis said, grinning. "The devil alone knows what it means."
"Madamas, Satanas," Gertrude Wyatt was shouting with all his or her might. Smackamuckus, Bominius, Pondocronius, Comontus.
Did you hear the like? Francis inquired.
Sounds a bit indecent to me, Fred retorted. I bet they were filthy lot old back in the 17-something. I say, what must it be like for a man to be in a woman's body?
It's been done before, Francis shrugged.
Now shut up. I think someone is receiving loud and clear. There was a sound of many doors opening, followed by the clattering of running footsteps. The hall seemed to dissolve. The walls fell inward, and in the blink of an eyelid, the long, door-lined passage flashed into being. The tall, dark man was hurrying towards the open doorway, his face a mask of terrible rage. The wretched figure in the chair seemed to shrink. Speech babbled off the tongue in a cascade of words.
Locked out, master. He locked me out. Found out, powerful he be. We tried to contact. I tried, but too far, master. We were too far off.
Royston Wentworth clenched his fist and hammered them against the invisible wall. The dull thud gradually gave way to a terrible cracking sound, as though a brick or rock wall were splintering, that there was a mighty crash as a tall, black-clad figure stepped into the room. Several other men were creeping along the passage. They stopped at the doorway, seemingly unwilling or perhaps lacking the courage to cross the barrier. Royston Wentworth stood looking down at the bound figure that cringed in a chair. "An ass has more wisdom than its head than thou," he stated.
"Yes, he wasn't very bright," Francis agreed. "A spare key would have saved you a lot of trouble."
The arrogant eyes turned slowly in his direction. The thin lips were parted in a mirthless grin.
"I will pluck your soul from your body and toss it down upon the dark plains, where it will be hunted by the hounds of death."
"There again," Francis continued, "you aren't all that smart."
"Try to talk English," Fred instructed. "He hasn't a clue what you're on about."
"I said," Francis shouted, "your head has lost its wisdom."
"Oh, damn. I can't talk this jargon.
The idea was for your souls to come across, not your flipping bodies.
You're on alien ground, son. You're in my territory. Get it? Savvy?"
"Of course he doesn't," Fred protested. "He probably thinks you're taking the Mickey." It was not clear if Royston Wentworth understood what was being said or not, but his intention was unmistakable. He was moving towards Francis, arms outstretched, the fingers slightly curved, and he was growling deep down in his throat. Francis sidestepped, then began to retreat. He slid a small table across the floor so that it bumped against the ledge of the approaching giant, causing him to stumble. Wentworth recovered at last, kicked the table to one side, then continued his relentless advance. Fred picked the table up and threw it at the broad back. It struck Wentworth between the shoulder blades, and instantly he turned with incredible speed and made for the petrified girl.
"Move!" Francis shouted. "Run!"
His warning was unheeded. A hand that looked as if it might have been hewn out of granite swung round and slashed across Fred's left cheek. She went hurling backwards, bounced off a chair, then collapsed on the floor. Francis forgot his cautious tactics and went in like a boxer going out for a knockdown. He slammed a combination of punches into the hard belly, then executed a perfect uppercut to the jutting chin. He repeated the process 3 times. Finally, he rubbed his raw knuckles and looked up. Wentworth's face wore a derisive grin.
"Bloody hell," Francis swore, as he tried to back away, but the great hand found his throat, and he was being forced down to his knees.
While the ridiculous thought flashed across his mind, is this a story where the baddie wins? Consciousness was dissolving into a bottomless pit. His soul was preparing to depart for an unknown destination when a brown object flew across the room and smashed against Wentworth's face. The steel fingers were jerked from Francis' throat, and he sank to the floor, gasping for breath. Wentworth was screaming. His hands were clasped over the cut, inflamed face. Reggie Smith looked down at Francis and shrugged.
"What else could I do?"
"I threw the teapot at him." Francis came gradually back to life and gazed upon the writhing giant with speechless astonishment. Not until he had clambered to his feet was he able to give utterance.
"The cup that cheers," he said slowly.
"The life-saving brew. Reggie, you're a bloody marvel. Hand me that small table."
Reggie obeyed him. Francis crashed the table down on Wentworth's head, just as the giant was about to take a more active interest in the proceedings.
"Sleep," he advised, "and wake up in a more depressing yesterday." Wentworth acceded to this request by crashing to the floor, where he lay like a felled oak waiting for the jacksaw. Francis began to straighten the prostrate figure as Fred climbed slowly to his feet and rubbed the ugly red weal that marred her left cheek.
"Rope," he said, snapping his fingers. "Curtain cords, nylons, your knickers, anything."
After a hurried scramble with Reggie watched with an appreciative eye, Fred handed him Francis a pair of sheer nylons which he used to secure the giant ankles and wrist. He then straightened up and surveyed his handiwork with a certain justified pride. Number one ungodly lay du haut. Now to put him back where he belongs. Reggie, do you feel strong?
No.
Good. Catch hold of his legs while I take a firm grip of his manly shoulders. Reggie displayed a certain reluctance to lay hands on the enemy, particularly as four sinister-looking individuals were watching the operation from the open doorway. They had not moved since Wentworth had invaded the sitting room, but were now showing signs of disquiet, as it became evident their leader was being returned onto them. Reggie looked fearfully back over one shoulder. "What about those men?" he whispered. "Don't worry your little head," Francis advised, then shouted to Fred, "Switch the television on."
"Which channel?" Fred inquired.
"Independent. A few commercials should put the fear of the devil in him."
"They do me."
Slowly, with great effort, they dragged Wentworth towards the open doorway. The silent audience retreated a few steps, and one shook his head.
"That's interesting," Francis observed. "They don't seem keen on having Laughingly Boy back."
"That's too bad. Back he goes, whether they like it or not." It proved impossible to throw the body through the doorway for the simple reason it was too long. Wentworth's weight negated any idea of tossing him in head first, and Francis was coming to a reluctant conclusion when signs of extreme agitation among the silent audience made them look around. The television screen was depicting a monkey dressed in an 18th-century costume who was drinking from a teacup.
"There's nothing I like better than a cup of Rosie Lee," said the monkey.
The four men turned on their heels and raced down the passage. Their flight was followed by the sound of many doors opening and closing, then silence.
"You know," Francis said, taking a firmer grip on Wentworth's shoulders, "I never realized before the true virtue of tea."
"Right. Let's get him in there." After much straining, heaving, and grunting, they deposited their burden upon the stone floor, then looked round. Reggie was shaking like a jelly in an earthquake.
"Where?"
He stopped. The situation robbed him of words. "In the 18th century," Francis nodded. "In the Clarence Old Prison, and heaven help us if the bridge disintegrates before we get back. Still, it would be a shame if we didn't have a look around." Beyond the doorway, the sitting room and the color television was indisputably 20th century. But on either side and behind, the distant past was as real as Monday morning. Francis opened one of the doors and entered a cell which was bare save for a plank bed and an iron bucket. He went back into the passage and was greeted by a terrified Reggie, who was gazing longingly at the cozy sitting room.
"I think we ought to get back. There are those men. They keep looking round the corner."
Even then, a fearful face was peering at them from the nearest corner, but when Francis shouted, "Boo!" quite loudly, it instantly disappeared.
"Perhaps you're right," he admitted reluctantly, "but it would have been nice to explore a little longer, particularly if I fetched the camera. Think what the Sunday papers would pay for a photograph of your actual 18th century."
"Francis," Fred called, "come quickly. Gertrude is playing up and I can't do anything with her." They tore back into the sitting room and there was a possessed Gertrude staring at the television screen with obvious terror.
"Hasn't she ever seen a TV before?" Francis asked Reggie.
"The real Gertrude, I mean?"
"She certainly never saw ours, and I don't suppose her old mother owns one."
"Then there's no memory to draw upon," Francis remarked, thoughtfully. "Turn over to the other side." Fred pushed a button, and there was an instant picture of a big man hitting a little man with all his strength. Gertrude White screamed.
"We will put you in yon box," Francis promised, "and you will be hit by a big man for all eternity."
The camera moved in a close-up of the little man's face. It looked like a lump of raw meat.
"Back to the other channel," Francis ordered.
A man was running towards the camera. Suddenly, a shot rang out, and a nasty red stain appeared on the man's shirt front. He made an interesting gurgling sound and crashed to the pavement.
"We will make you small, shrink you smaller than small, then put you in yon box," Francis informed the speechless Gertrude Wyatt, "for that is the gateway to hell. Turn over to BBC2, Fred."
The screech of brakes, the roar of guns, the thud of fists on bare flesh, followed by an ear-splitting scream. Something gray, a wisp of mist, streaked towards the open doorway, and instantly the passage vanished, to be replaced by the hall. Francis wiped his brow.
"Never thought it would work. Lucky they chose a simple mind. Any sign of the real Gertrude, Fred?"
"No need to worry," Fred was untying the confining cords. "As soon as she wakes up, the rightful spirit will return just as ours does when we wake each morning."
"Has
"Has the bridge gone for good?" Reggie asked, looking anxiously at the empty hall. "Sure thing. The anchorman has belted back across the river. It might as well be as if some alterations to the hall. Replaced the floorboards, did a spot of redecorations that the vibrations are changed. But I think your house will behave itself from now on. Oh, I see our wanderer has returned. Best turn the television off." Gertrude opened her eyes. She looked slowly around, then up at Reggie Smith.
"Mr. Smith, sir, I had a funny dream. I was walking around the house, and nobody took notice of me."
"Now you must go home, Gertrude, for night has fallen." She rose from the chair, looking fearfully at the overhead lamp, then at the drawn curtains. "My mom says I'm not to be out after dark, and me asleep in your best armchair, sir."
"Why mustn't you be out after dark?" Francis asked slyly. "Afraid of ghosts?"
"No, I don't believe in that nonsense. It be the men with evil in their arts that do prowl around in the darkness."
Francis smiled. "May wisdom always be with you, Gertrude."
They crowded round the car expressing gratitude, the women cooing, the men doing their best to be hearty, their minds already forgetting. It was Betty Smith who asked the final, so far unanswered question.
"Miss Masters, Fred, I hope you don't mind me asking, but surely your initials are F.M.?"
"That's right." Fred climbed into the seat next to Francis. "Then, why the letters E.V. that are so beautifully embroidered on your dress? What do they stand for?"
The car began to glide slowly away. Fred's voice came back to them, clear, untroubled, the voice of Helen calling over the walls of Troy.
X. Virgin.